I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke today proposed that banks get approval for pay packages for tens of thousands of bankers. This is on the heels of a European Union statement urging the G20, the world's 20 largest economies, to adopt strict rules on bankers' bonuses at next week's meeting in Pittsburgh. Already before Congress are suggestions for more Federal Reserve oversight of Wall Street and a separate Consumer Financial Protection Agency. So where are we on reform? We want to spend a few minutes today with Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren. She's chair of the congressional panel charged with monitoring the Treasury's $700 billion bank bailout. And she's also the woman who thought up and shaped one of the most controversial and far-reaching proposals in front of Congress today. No, it's not health care reform. It is that Consumer Financial Protection Agency. Elizabeth Warren joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And just remind us, we know a little bit about your thoughts. We want to delve deeper into what you hope happens for consumers. But where is the thinking about a financial commission just for them?
Well, you mean where is it in terms of where it's working through Washington?
Yeah, where is it in the pipeline?
So where it is in the pipeline is that the administration put out a white paper in June and then that said, here are our general ideas. And the Consumer Financial Protection Agency was sort of the keystone. There were five proposal areas, and one was on consumer, and it was this agency. And then they put out statutory language in July, you know, a 365-page bill specifically on this part of it. And then in August, when ordinary folks went on vacation, right, or kept on working, whichever they were doing, a lot of the staffers stayed here and continued to work on the language in the legislation. And now we're in September, and Barney Frank is moving it forward in the House, and then it will be up to Chris Dodd and Senator Shelby in the Senate start moving it.
Well, and a lot of people are pushing back against it from the industry. The president of the American Bankers Association says this is going to be a huge fight. The agency you propose would have broad powers that go beyond every consumer law that's ever been enacted. Tell us specifically what you want, because you've written and have said in testimony before Congress that you cannot buy a toaster with a 1 in 5 chance of it blowing up. But until this financial crisis started to change things, you could refinance your home with a loan that had a 5 in 1 chance of putting your family out on the street. What would you like to see an agency do?
What I'd like to do is I'd like to have an agency that actually works. The market is broken right now, both the regulatory market and the overall consumer credit market. So we have 7 different agencies in Washington that own a piece of the consumer credit regulation. But in addition to that, if you decide not to get a federal charter, you can decide to stay as an unregulated lender, the way that different mortgage brokers, for example, are, or payday lenders. And what that really means is there's no coherent set of rules. So we get a different set of rules if a mortgage is issued by a federally chartered bank, different if it's issued by a federally chartered thrift, different if it's issued by a state institution. The idea is to say, hey, wait a minute, that just doesn't work. What it does is it permits the crafty to slip between the cracks and also to play one agency off against another, because agency budgets depend on how many folks they get to regulate. So the idea behind this is to say, look, we're going to have one set of rules for mortgages, and it doesn't make any difference the legal entity that issues the mortgage. If it's a mortgage that goes out to a consumer, there's a baseline set of safety rules. Same thing for credit cards, same thing for car loans.
Well, you're even proposing one form for mortgages where there's a blank and the lenders just fill in the percentage, the ARM, they just fill in some of the information. But Mortgage Bankers Association President John Corson says this would stifle innovation and limit consumer choices. This has been sold as an era of more choices. But how would you respond to that?
Well, you know, I to tell you the truth, I think that this just, their response doesn't make any sense. They're saying we love things the way they are. So let's stop and ask, who benefits from the fact that when you show up at a closing on a home mortgage, there can be somewhere between 200 and 400 pages of documentation, and they just have it all stickered and say, sign here, sign here, sign here, and sign here. Nobody reads that stuff. Nobody understands that. Who profits from that? Who profits from the fact that your credit card is 30 pages if you add up all the little inserts that came along? And all of it, frankly, most of it, is incomprehensible. Who profits from that? Not the consumer. The ones who profit are the lenders who are able to hide a bunch of tricks and traps, you know, back on page 26.
What would you want to see with credit cards?
What I like to see is I really would like to see a one page, page and a half, maybe 2 pages credit card agreement. And it just puts the basic terms right up front in big print and says, here's the deal. Here's the interest rate. Here's the penalty rate. Here's what triggers a penalty. Here's how much it's going to cost to get your free gift. And that's it. And the consumer looks at it and says, okay, now I can compare from one card to another and see that the actual cost of this card is 17% and that card is 29% and this card over here is 12%. And the consumer can make an informed choice and this market can start to work again. Look, I'm all for binding consumers. I'm all for personal responsibility. But let them see what the terms are right up front.
Well, and we've been listening to the opponents. Among the early ones, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo. What do you think happens now in about the minute we have?
Well, let's face it. They've got all the money, right? Their money is at stake. They're going to say everything they can. They're going to do everything they can. There is a storm of lobbying going on here in Washington, because the banks like business as usual. They want to dress it up in other words, but the bottom line is they want to say, the system works like it is. We're very comfortable with it, and we make a lot of money from it, and we want it to stay the same. The question is, what about the rest of us? What about the whole rest of the country that's on the losing end of these contracts? Which side will Congress go with?
Well, and just in the few seconds we have, what's your guess? This has sort of been derailed.
Well, I don't think it has been derailed. You know, for years we said you couldn't beat the tobacco industry, and then finally that changed. For years we've all said you can't beat the banking industry. They always, always, always win. I think this is a special moment. We have paid the price for what happens when the bankers are left in charge. And I don't think the American people are going to put up with that anymore.
Elizabeth Warren of Harvard University and chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel to monitor TARP. Elizabeth, Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We have a passing to note today. Leon Kirchner, one of America's greatest composers, died yesterday at the age of 90. Winner of a Pulitzer Prize in 1967, he was also an accomplished pianist and conductor, and he created and for 30 years taught Harvard's highly regarded Music 180 course, cellist Yo-Yo Ma, one of his students. His influence was felt around the world. He was influenced by Arnold Schoenberg and Stravinsky. But Kirchner insisted on also embracing traditional romantic classical music. Earlier this year, to mark his 90th birthday, his many friends paid a musical birthday tribute to Kirchner at Boston's Isabella Gardner Museum. We went to a rehearsal with flautist Paula Robeson and percussionist Ayano Katoka, and the sole audience member, the always imposing figure of Leon Kirchner, bright, piercing eyes peering out from under bushy eyebrows under a mop of hair.
Okay, here we go. I'll say in general that you're taking too seriously the fermatas.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Could you make daga a little tiny bit faster? Dam parim. Try that. Dam pari.
Wait.
Wait there. No, hold it. Hold it. And then now the next phrase.
Paula Robeson, is that intimidating to have the composer there, or are you so close with him at this point? What is that like?
Well, we're so close. I feel like we're family. But in a sense, Leon is always challenging to play for because he has such a clear vision. What is, to me, the most extraordinary about his extraordinary music is the way he reaches for the ineffable, the way he tries to ask us to express the inexpressible.
There's always comparisons to others. How would you describe Leon Kirchner's sound?
When you hear a piece of Kirchner, it can be written by no one else but him.
Tell us why.
The intervals that he uses, the way he uses voice leading. I've often thought about Leon as kind of in a tossing sea. In a boat, when we play a piece, as if we're in a some sort of a craft that's on this ocean, and that he's trying to make it to the shore.
In the boat with Kirchner, his early influences, Stravinsky, and most notably his teacher, Arnold Schoenberg, the creator of the 12-tone technique, a system for expressing the atonal, dissonant music of the early 1900s.
Sometimes Schoenberg is writing in the boat with him because he did gain so much from Schoenberg, but Schoenberg comes from the European tradition. Leon is an American, so he has that gutsy, big band kind of tradition that we as Americans have and treasure. And so here we are in the boat. I think some of the Schoenberg disciples made it to the shore. Some of them kind of dried out on the shore. Some of them built gigantic fortresses that nobody could understand. But here Leon kind of stayed at sea, always reaching. He's always kept his beating heart. As he says of Schoenberg's disciples, so many of them just went with the numbers, the system. They didn't keep the waltz, the heart.
There was Stravinsky, Schoenberg, Bartok, and all the rest. You must never consider them when you talk to people like me. These people were not born on this planet. I am absolutely convinced of that.
Because why? They were hearing something that nobody else could hear before then?
That's right. Nobody else did hear before.
What did it do to you when the world that Stravinsky and Schoenberg presented opened up?
One day, in 1950, I received a phone call, and somebody on the other end had the nerve to say, "This is Igor Stravinsky. I have listened to your quartet. I should like you to come to dinner with your wife." Well, I immediately, being a very clever fellow, said, "I accept. My name is Fyodor Dostoevsky, and I have written some things you might see while you look at the music." And it was actually true.
It was
and
him.
The person said, no, this is Igor Stravinsky. You come on a certain day.
Composer Leon Kirchner, as we listen to a little of the Stravinsky that inspired him as a young man. When we come back, how Leon, in turn, inspired his former student, Yo-Yo Ma, who at first didn't understand when Leon told him to play as if he was careening through the music.
I said, this is what is happening to the harmonies. It's like moving away from the gravity of the sun on a whole new course. And this is what you have to feel. He actually began to careen throughout the world. He would write me a card and say, "I just played with von Karajan last night. I still don't understand what you meant by careening."
Leon Kirchner died yesterday at the age of 90. When we come back, we'll have more of our conversation and one last kiss from his former student, Yo-Yo Ma. In a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
We are remembering the great American composer Leon Kirchner today. The Pulitzer Prize winner died yesterday of heart failure in his New York home. He was 90. We're revisiting a piece we did earlier this year ahead of a 90th birthday tribute concert for the composer at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. There was also one in New York. Full disclosure, Leon Kirchner was a former neighbor of mine here when he lived in the Boston area, although for years I didn't know who he was. I knew him as Leon, who played gorgeous piano that I'd hear through his window. One day, while we walked back from the store, I said, "Leon, you can really play. You should keep that up." He said, "I will." The next day, I opened the paper to see he'd debuted a new piece with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. We laughed a lot about that. And when we spoke before his birthday celebration at the Garden Museum last spring, I asked Leon Kirchner about his relationship with cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Kirchner was known as Yo-Yo's greatest mentor when he taught him at Harvard, but he was also very critical of him.
"I'm always critical of everyone whom I respect. I did tell Yo-Yo one day, I said, you know, Yo-Yo has the quality of genius. He's probably one of the greatest cellists alive. But I told him, you know, you don't have any center to your tone. There's no center to your tone. He was shocked that I said, I don't mean just the tone of your cello. I mean the tone of your soul. And sometime later, cellist named Rostropovich came and asked for five people. He wanted to give a master class, and I selected the best of them. Rostropovich came out, first cellist played. Ah, it's beautiful, beautiful. The second one came in. He said, ah, like Christmas cake. And then the third one came. Fourth one came, and he said something else, all of the same order. And when the fifth one came,
Yo-Yo Ma.
Yo-Yo Ma, he said, you know, you have no center to your tone.
Do you remember the moment when he did find it? Because obviously he did.
Yes. He found it the next day, actually.
And what is it? What did he get?
He got hold of life.
Yo-Yo Ma was in the audience at the Garden Museum to see his former teacher feted, and afterward it was obvious that the classroom teachings stayed with him.
Where's your core? Where is your core?
Just how tough, Yo-Yo Ma, was Leon Kirchner on you?
Oh, he was my boulder in the road, as he calls himself. He was so loving, but he really liked to create challenges. And I think, in hindsight, rightfully so, because he had an unbelievable vaulting imagination. And he challenged everybody to try and rise to that level of thinking and of feeling and of making sure that the sounds that we make are powered by ideas as well as feelings.
What do you feel when you play Kirchner music?
Well, clusters, gestures, shapes, and movement, and all kind of jostling together, you know, bursting sparks, and I mean, just amazing colors that are just kind of exploding, but also full of heart. You know, we were joking earlier about the rapapapapim, you know, it's these wave-like motions that can come out of his brain and in his writing and his singing and his personality.
This is a piece that Leon Kirchner wrote for Yo-Yo Ma. It's called Music for Cello and Orchestra. I asked Leon Kirchner, given the mutual affection between the two, what kind of a piece did he want to write?
Well, I wrote the most beautiful piece because that's what my wife said. I said, what should I do next? Write something that has beauty in it. And so I put my whole heart and soul into that work, and he gave it one of the most wonderful performances.
You mentioned your late wife, Gertrude.
Yes.
I heard a story about how Yo-Yo came and played for her when she was dying.
Yeah. Well, Gertrude was very ill, and she was sort of sleeping, and Yo-Yo just had this wonderful habit of coming and playing a Bach Sarabande, or actually a whole suite. I said, Gert, Yo-Yo, she adored Yo-Yo. Somebody was talking about pickles and music. I don't know how that came up. And so I said, well, Gert, what do you want? Do you want pickles or Yo-Yo? She said pickles. So I said, that's terrible. I didn't say that to her. But Yo-Yo closed his cello, banged it, went out. And that was the end of him, it seemed, until he came back about an hour later with six different pickle bottles and presented them to her. And then he played one of the great suites of Bach. And that was a great, grand, grand affair. Wonderful, wonderful human being.
It was so fantastic.
Oh, this is...
We're going to careen away.
One last kiss from Yo-Yo Ma to his former teacher, Leon Kirshner. Kirshner was honored last year. He was also a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer and pianist. He died yesterday at the age of 90. Leon Kirshner's Trio No. 1, he leaves his son Paul, daughter Lisa, and a granddaughter, his partner Sally. His wife Gertrude died in 1999, and he leaves his music. We'll be back after the latest news with Larry David, Here and Now. The Jewish High Holy Days begin at sunset today with the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah. And many synagogues are hoping the new year will be better than the last one. By one estimate, Jewish organizations lost a quarter of their wealth in the economic downturn. Some charities were completely shut down by the Bernie Madoff scandal. Others are making fewer grants to synagogues. But it's the congregants who are suffering the most. Rabbi Charles Klein of the Merrick Jewish Center on New York's Long Island is with us. Rabbi Klein, how bad is it?
There is an unprecedented level of the number of people who are coming to their rabbis seeking some kind of assistance, some kind of relief, some kind of help. I've been a rabbi, Robin, for 35 years, have never seen anything or experienced anything like this.
Well, part of it has to do with the financial structure of synagogues. Now, you don't pass a collection plate. Synagogues rely on dues, right?
Yeah, we rely on dues and, of course, voluntary contributions on top of dues.
And the dues can be, you know, thousands of dollars a year. If Christians think about, you know, some faiths tithe 10% of their income.
Right.
Some people give, you know, a lot of money every Sunday. So dues in temples, well, how high can they run?
Well, you know, obviously it's on a sliding scale in terms of different congregations, different areas of the country. A Long Island reference point would be that dues are approximately $1,500.
And so generally, members need to have their dues paid up to get the coveted seats at these high holy days that are coming, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur later this month.
Well, let's put it this way. Those were the good old days. I know in my congregation, we're trying to be as understanding, compassionate, sensitive as we can. We're looking to make certain that people who have been members of the congregation come in to worship with us and be a part of the congregation on the High Holy Days. And we're hoping that they will understand the moral commitment they have to try to do the best they can to support and sustain the congregation.
So you're helping people if they can't pay the dues. But I'm wondering what that conversation is like. If somebody, you know, has to say, and in some cases, maybe they're not saying it, maybe they're just leaving. Are you having that happen where people are embarrassed they can't pay their dues?
Both. For the people that you get the sense are just dropping off, you have to be proactive, reach out to them, and then try to reel them back in. And, you know, by suggesting to them that their participation, their membership is something we value and cherish, and that we will work with them through this difficult time. On the other hand, the calls that come in from people who are feeling as low about themselves as perhaps they've been in their entire adult life. It is a very difficult thing to talk to someone when they are feeling defeated, when they are feeling despondent, and have to turn to you because they can't pay the dues to the synagogue.
Yeah. What are people doing across the country? We're reading about one temple that has a campaign called No Family Without High Holy Days. We're hearing about support groups in the Detroit area for kids whose parents lost jobs in the auto industry. You know, what other things are temples doing because of the financial hit?
In our congregation, I asked people to contribute to a special fund that would enable me to give relief to people in urgent situations. We collected a lot of money for that. We created a wonderful program of job networking. We have a social worker who is absolutely involved in this, doing a lot of the psychosocial work that comes along with this kind of situation. You know, it's not just the problem of someone being fired, which is a daunting problem. It's also the stress and strain it places on the marriage, on the family life. People need someone to turn to talk about these issues.
Does it put a damper on the new year?
Well, you know, look, I think, Robin, one of the aspects of Jewish life that is so terribly inspiring is that in the most challenging times in our history, the Jewish people have been able to recover and go on to do magnificent things.
That's the Rabbi Charles Klein of the Merrick Jewish Center on New York's Long Island. As we approach the High Holy Days, Rabbi, is it Shana Tova? Happy New Year?
Shana Tova and Robin, Shana Tova and Mituka, which means a good and sweet year.
As they say, from your lips to God's ears.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll be back in 30 seconds with a look at the scandal over Acorn. Congress has voted to block the group's federal funding. 30 seconds, here and now. Both houses of Congress voted overwhelmingly yesterday to block federal funding for the activist community organization Acorn. You've probably seen the damning undercover videos that were released first on the internet last week that showed some Acorn staffers counseling two conservative activists posing as a pimp and a prostitute on how to file taxes for their obviously illegal business. Conservatives have long been critical of Acorn, accusing the group of voter registration fraud and linking them to then-candidate Barack Obama through one of his previous jobs. Acorn says the undercover sting threw a wide net but only caught a handful of workers who've been fired, and Acorn officials say those workers are rare. In Philadelphia, police do confirm that Acorn workers called them after the undercover couple showed up and was told to leave. Ben Smith is senior political reporter for Politico.com. Ben, let's start with some basic profile information. What is Acorn? How long has it been around? What do they do?
Well, Acorn is a group that was born, I think, in the 1970s out of a really kind of genuinely radical impulse to kind of organize and empower poor people. It's, at least in theory, a membership organization financed by its members who are overwhelmingly, you know, poor people, a lot of them in big cities. The center of the organizing has been in places like Arkansas and Louisiana in the South. And it has, over the years, gone in a bunch of different directions. It does sort of overtly political activity, voter registration drives particularly. It also has taken on a lot of kind of social service functions, sometimes getting government money, either local or federal, to, you know, counsel people about housing or about how to get food stamps, things like that. It has, I think, 71 offices around the country. In some cities, like in New York City, it's a big local political player and basically a pretty normal local political player. Mike Bloomberg was photographed kissing the head of Acorn, Bertha Lewis, on the lips when they sealed some deal. And so they're not, you know, they're not a kind of marginal fringe group.
Well, let's stay at funding. On one of the undercover tapes, it's said that Acorn is expected to get up to $8.5 billion in government funds. But the Washington Post reports today that that's a huge exaggeration. It's assuming that Acorn would apply for and receive every federal project and grant in the country. And Acorn, by the way, says they're not even applying for any stimulus funds.
That is a sort of a canard. I think they've gotten the number that you'll see thrown around is $53 million, but that's since 1994. So they've been getting a few million dollars a year in the kind of government grants that a lot of nonprofits get, but they can survive without the federal government supporting them.
Well, but can they survive the outcry? These recent videos were made by two young activists. One, Hannah Giles, was trained at the Young Americas Foundation. That's a conservative funded media training center for young people. The other, James O'Keefe, calls himself a self-trained investigative journalist. They dressed up, as we said, as a pimp with his prostitute, and some of the tape they got is pretty damning. Just a little bit of the scenes on the tape.
Oh, these two kids dressed, I mean, preposterously as a pimp and a prostitute. He's wearing, I think it was her grandmother's fur coat, something like that. Mm-hmm. Come in and ask advice on, you know, how to evade taxes for the illegal underage Ecuadorian prostitutes they're planning to install in a house, and then, you know, recycle the money to launch his political career. And in a couple of the offices in Washington and Baltimore, the workers seem maybe mildly amused, but not so fazed by this that they don't go ahead and offer advice on how to run a prostitution business in what's supposed to be kind of a tax counseling session for poor people. And I think what it exposes is something about this group's internal culture that's real, which is that their roots in this kind of radical movement kind of produce a certain disdain for the rules and for the rule of law. And the group says it's been struggling with. Their founder was actually kind of marginalized over the last couple of years when it was found that he had concealed his brother's massive embezzlement from the organization. So I think there is through and through a culture of a certain kind of disdain for the rules, and that's what this video has exposed.
And yet, as you say, they are embraced by city officials in some cities. They're trying to, you know, shake that off. And in a couple of the cases of the film, it's been misrepresented. In Los Angeles, a worker says, yeah, I killed my husband. And she and Acorn claim that she was just playing the couple. The police in Los Angeles confirm there are no husbands who are dead. And as we said in Philadelphia, they called the police because they did think someone was playing a trick on them. But the tape that this couple did get is damning and playing over and over and over again. What's been the impact?
Well, you know, it plays into this sort of grand unified theory of Acorn that has been building up on the right for quite a while. And I think John McCain at some point dressed somebody in a squirrel suit and had them running around outside presidential debates, which links what in this case was social service provision and doing it quite shadily to voter registration efforts, which have been troubled by not voter fraud, not faking up votes, but by incredibly sloppy and fraudulent voter registrations where they're turning in faked up voter registrations for people who don't exist.
We should say last week in Florida, 11 Acorn workers were arrested and charged with this voter registration fraud. This is where the name Mickey Mouse showed up on the lists. Again, no voting, but as you said, the lists.
Right, and the thing about this is what has not been shown is that anybody was voting illegally. So certainly it's a crime to swear an affidavit that you've registered this voter when you're lying and you're doing it because you're getting paid, you know, a dollar per voter you register, and it's easier to do it at your kitchen table than it is to actually go out and find people. But that is very different from casting fake votes in an election. And what has not been shown is that they're doing that. And in fact, I was talking to a very prominent Democratic political operative today, and he was saying, you know, it's so funny that Republicans are so worked up about Acorn because they're kind of useless to us. Their registrations are messy. The people they're registering, like random people that they encounter on the street, are the least likely to vote.
Well, you say, someone said it's so funny that Republicans are doing this, but I'm holding the New Time magazine. Its cover reads Mad Man, and there's a huge picture of conservative talk show host Glenn Beck sticking his tongue out, and he's claiming real victory because he's been writing Acorn for a long time, and now there are these tapes. Can the organization survive, and how much does this hurt Barack Obama in particular, who once worked for a law firm that represented Acorn at one time a long time ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think these are distinct questions, right? Can Acorn survive? I mean, maybe, but do we care a lot as a country whether this group survives or not?
Well,
I mean,
some people who, you know, got housing from them might.
Sure, sure. Yeah. They are among the groups that get grants to counsel people on how to get food stamps. If they were not getting that grant, somebody else would get that grant. I'm a little resistant to kind of the grand unified theory of all this. And, you know, they have all sorts of connections to all sorts of groups on the left. They work with the SEIU, which in turn is a major player politically. But they are not themselves a hugely major player, and their stature has been massively inflated by this nebulous conspiracy theory about them. And I think it has sort of fed this sense among people who are predisposed to believe that the left is doing extremely devious things, that in fact the left is doing extremely devious things. But I'm just not sure there is a broader indictment of, for instance, the Obama administration, because, as you said, he was a lawyer for a group that was connected to Acorn many years ago.
Well, we'll have to see how that plays out. Ben Smith, senior political reporter for Politico.com in Washington, D.C. Ben, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Larry?
Robin?
I'm trying to think of the show.
Come on. It's so obvious. Want me to do it again?
Go. Oh, it's Gershwin. It's American in Paris.
Yes.
Who knew? Larry David, the Seinfeld co-creator who plays that crusty guy named Larry David on the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, has enthusiasm, whistles Gershwin while he waits for people to come to the phone, which is what he was doing when we reached him in his Santa Monica, California office. I just have to say, I'm pleasantly surprised to hear you in such a good mood.
You know, what, do you think that on the show I'm cranky?
Yeah. You think?
Do I come off as cranky? I've heard that before, and frankly, I'm a little surprised.
I was going to ask you, you know, how are you? But then I thought that's way too loaded a question.
No, I actually am a much happier person than people would ever think.
Curb Your Enthusiasm opens its seventh season Sunday night. During the season, the whole Seinfeld cast is reuniting on the show, in which Larry David plays a version of himself, a successful but, as we said, malcontent comedian, writer, producer who got rich from his Seinfeld success. In this scene, Larry meets with a friend whose sister has just been released from a mental institution.
You know, if there's anything I can do, you let me know.
You can come over today at 1 o'clock and visit with her.
Visit her?
Yeah.
What, are you kidding?
Why, you didn't mean it?
Of course not.
Why did you say it then?
You know, it was something, an empty gesture. It was something to say.
Larry David on the show is my dream. That's the person I aspire to be. I love that guy. Love him.
What about him?
He's not afraid of anything. He's extremely honest. And I'm the opposite.
So you would really want to be a guy who would tell a gay couple that one of them looks gayer than the other, or...
Well, no, I went over to him and I said, I'm surprised that you're gay, because he didn't seem gay.
And he says, what does
he mean? And he got offended, and then his partner said...
His partner said, wait, you're saying he doesn't seem gay, but I do?
Yeah, and right, so he asked me, and I said, yeah, well, yes, you seem gay. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, people don't say things like this. You say things like this. You say the bubble above everybody else's head.
On the show, I do. I don't.
It.
I don't do it in life. That's why I like doing it so much.
Well, and as we said, this season, the whole Seinfeld cast comes on the show, and you manipulate them to do a Seinfeld reunion as a way to win back your TV wife, Cheryl, who left you last season. But she's an actress, so you think she'll come back if you can cast her in the reunion show. Here you are pitching the idea of a reunion to Jerry.
I remember you talking about whenever a sitcom does a reunion episode, you say, isn't it pathetic?
I said pathetic?
Desperate, pathetic.
Desperate.
You see people who do not have your aesthetic standards, and you criticize and downgrade them for it. That's your style.
Well, how do you feel about real reunions? Will there be a real Seinfeld reunion?
No. No, this is the closest that we'll ever get to that.
Well, we wondered something else because Curb Your Enthusiasm is supposed to be loosely based on your life. And so, kind of a sensitive question, perhaps. Part of the reason you launch a Seinfeld reunion show on Curb Your Enthusiasm is ostensibly to get your TV wife back. And we know that your real-life wife, Lori David, who was the woman behind Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth film, people know her in her own right, you divorced. Are you also trying to get your real-life wife back through a Seinfeld reunion?
Yeah, well, she's not an actress that I can cast, so no, we've both moved on, as they say.
Okay, well, let's get back to the new season, in which Larry David almost derails the Seinfeld reunion show because he ticks off everyone, including Julia Louis-Dreyfus. He's accused her of making up an excuse not to see him.
It is totally and completely unacceptable that you would grill my daughter, Gracie, about whether I took her to a birthday party, and then you call me a liar?
Oh, okay, first of all, I didn't really grill her. I just asked a question, and I didn't call you a liar. I just said it was interesting.
You know, Julia and Jason and Michael and even Jerry to some extent, I mean, they're really good sports about what I asked them to do on the show this year, because they're playing themselves, but it's nothing remotely like them.
Well, you know, it's funny. Jason Alexander, who plays George on Seinfeld, the George character was supposed to be loosely based on you. And when Jason is having lunch with you on Curb, he really puts down the character of George, which is dizzying to watch because it's a character that plays you, insulting you, and you've written it, so it's you insulting you.
Yeah, but he doesn't really feel that way.
Well, he also disses the Seinfeld season finale, which, again, you wrote.
Yes.
And expectations were so high. There were some people who,
yes,
there was some criticism of it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay,
couldn't
hated it.
Stand it, yeah.
So here it is again. It's your work. And Curb is ad-libbed, or largely ad-libbed. You do an outline, and then they watercolor it in. So did you know, for instance, that Jason Alexander was going to put down the Seinfeld season finale?
No, that was not in the outline. He either made that up or was given to him by one of the producers.
I want to ask you about the moments, the Larry David moments sprinkled through the show arm wrestling your way with yourself through life. There's one example, and you know, it's been done before, but somehow you do it, and it's new. You can't get plastic packaging open.
Yes, that's infuriating. By the way, nothing about that scene, there was no acting in that scene, me trying to open up this plastic package. There was no perforation, and I really tried my hardest to get that package open, and I couldn't.
I'm presuming that life has been pretty good to you. You've had some successes and, you know, maybe you even have some help. You know, is life, is it really that hard?
Well, I still don't hand over plastic packaging to a butler, you know. I mean, no, life is not hard for me, but these things do come up. I do observe them.
It seems like what Larry David observes in Curb is that, you know, he may speak out about something and he gets in trouble, but everybody on the show acts out, and they don't. I'm thinking, here's Susie Green. She is the wife of Larry David's agent, Jeff. You, Larry, are confronting her because you diagnosed her case of Lyme disease, and she didn't seem to appreciate it. Let's listen.
Hey.
What?
No, thank you, Larry, for saving my life.
Saving my life? How'd you save my life? You didn't save my life.
I diagnosed your illness.
All right, well, it's treated, and I'm feeling great.
Give it up, man.
Give what up?
What kind of person doesn't say thank you to another person for,
you
know, saving
what?
Their life?
Oh,
I'm
Larry,
glad you're
thank
feeling
you so
better.
Much.
Well, here's where it's sort of Larry David, the everyman, a unique view of justice and morality.
I think that's so. I think I do have this set of rules, and I feel the world should be run in a particular way, and it annoys me that it's not.
So, Larry David, would you like to whistle us out?
Not bad, right?
You have done it your way.
Tell me the truth. I have a little talent for it, don't I?
You do.
Don't you think?
I do. Now, the Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm would walk down the street and ask every single person.
Yeah, exactly.
Larry David, creator of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which premieres its seventh season this Sunday on HBO. Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now the end is near. So I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear. I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full. I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Regrets I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did.